We have a guest with us today, as you can tell, whom Judge Ripple will introduce.
Judge Posner, Judge Mannion, ladies and gentlemen, I have the honor of introducing today Judge Hironori Yokoyama, a judge of the District Court in Tokyo, Japan. The judge is currently in the United States as a visiting scholar at the University of Notre Dame. Supreme Court of Japan has given him a year to study the American system of justice, and he is here today to observe our proceedings and to watch the attorneys present their cases. He has read all the briefs in the cases and looks forward to seeing how justice is administered in the United States. Judge, we are very pleased to have you with us today. Welcome.
Thank you. Judge Ripple? So we'll proceed to our first argument, which is Massey versus Johnson. Mr. Stegall.
Thank you, Judge Posner, and welcome to our distinguished guest. It's a privilege to be in front of and have him observe as well. This is a First Amendment retaliatory discharge case, a summary judgment. The Pickering-Connick balance test was conceded that the speech was protected, as indeed it must be, because the speech was a series of letters on wrongdoing by low-level employees to members of the Indiana legislature. So certainly that is the most fundamental of rights, to petition your legislators for redress of grievances and also to advise of wrongdoing. There was a summary judgment entered in favor of the defendants, who were the officers of the Vincennes University. Vincennes.
Why is Massey suing? You say in your brief on page 3 he has no lost income. You say Massey was a witness to Mills's claim, so he asserted his claim.
His claim is $3,400 of overtime they have not paid him. He certainly has a legal claim for damages, but
why is it that his witness status somehow, you suggest, maybe you didn't mean that, was motivated his claim?
If Massey were the only plaintiff, Your Honor, we wouldn't be here over $3,400. But since he's going to be involved in Mills's claim, I joined him as an additional plaintiff. And that's one of the arguments, and I think the strongest evidence of retaliatory intent is, why didn't they pay him the $3,400?
But if he earns substantially more in his next job, shouldn't that be an offset against the $3,400?
He did not the year in transition. He did the following year.
But he's done better, right? They did him a favor firing him.
No, right? They didn't do better that year.
No, but...
I mean, ultimately, he did better, yes.
Right, he ultimately did better, so they did him a favor.
No. In 2002, he was fired. The $3,400 was very important to him then because he was having to get furniture in a new apartment. In 2003, he did do better. But that doesn't mean he's not entitled to the money he earned. I mean, he earned his overtime for 2003, and the fact that, say, you're a savvy investor in 2004 and make a fortune doesn't mean that you're not owed the $3,400. And, of course, that's one of the arguments is, why in the world didn't they pay him the $3,400 that...
Well, they think he's a crook, right?
What?
They think he's crooked.
Well, their own records that they brought to the deposition show that he earned the money. His supervisor, Mike Hare, kept them on a calendar, which he testified and has to be accepted.
Yeah, well, no, but they believe that his medical slips, are fraudulent.
Even if his medical slips were, that doesn't mean he didn't own his overtime.
Well, that's a very strange argument, isn't it?
No, he earned his overtime.
Yeah, but he cheated them on another front, right?
No, he didn't.
Yes, he did with the fabricated medical leave.
Well, if you assume that their conclusion is true, which, again, I'll go to the factual questions there, is the bare facts of the matter were that there were two gossiping secretaries, including the deans, who said she was out to get him and said that instructed his direct supervisor to fire him. And they say, well, this doesn't look like one of the doctor's signatures here, and it's an outdated form. LaRoche, supposedly the one who was involved in firing, says, what does university counsel think? Mesmer say, and also says that Dean Johnson is the person in charge and would have to fire him. And Mesmer says, no, you're in charge. And we have a series of emails from March 22nd to April 12th over what we'll do with a third chef janitor, which is itself indicative of the vice president of the universities involved as well as the human resources director intimately. Finally, LaRoche asks again, well, what does counsel say? Well, counsel says what any good lawyer would. Let him tell his side of the story. And Mesmer and LaRoche says, well, I'm going to fire him. Never lets Massey tell his side of the story. Right there is the departure, and you can infer the retaliatory motive right there. Had they let him tell his side of the story, they would have found that a resident who worked for the Indiana Hand Center signed the off-work slip based on a legitimate history from a registered nurse. And I think the court's well aware, and certainly a jury would, is that physicians do not get intimately involved in paperwork like things like that. You hear the history, you say signing that. Nurses, you're off to get medical care, you're off, and the best person to know is the doctor's nurse. She does most of that in routine things like this and had authority to sign a signature. The second slip was signed by a registered nurse, Latondres, who observed it and was qualified to make that judgment on a Wishart hospital medical slip, which, of course, she was authorized to do. They call and say he wasn't admitted. Well, it doesn't have to be admitted for her to give an opinion. When you construe the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, actual letter of the person at the medical place, the Indiana Hand Center, with authority, the chief operating officer, did engage in all this gossip about, well, the signature's forged, and that says the form's outdated, it doesn't look like his. If you got any questions, call me. Nobody called. Nobody asked him. And, of course, LaRoche conceded that medical slips, the purpose of them is to verify he was ill. You also have the testimony of Mike Hare, Massey's direct supervisor there, who said that he was the best person he ever had. He was entirely reliable. He was never sick.
What about the statement that Mr. Massey is not one of our patients?
Well, he wasn't one of their patients at the agent. That doesn't mean he wasn't treated at the hospital or that the doctor saw him on the street and could have given the opinion.
Yeah, but they go by what information. This is what he had. They say he's not one of our patients, that they don't recognize the signature, that it's an outdated form. That's what they had before them. Maybe they could have had more, but that is at least a reason to fire him, and I think that's what you're trying to allege, that that's a pretext.
Well, I'm saying it's a pretext
because that point.
Their lawyer tells him, and he didn't make the firing decision when he got that. Their lawyer tells him, well, ask him. Why didn't he ask him? It takes 2 minutes. And
couldn't find him for a while.
Well, they didn't ask Mike Hare, who was his supervisor, who knew he was sick. I mean, if they talked to the person he talks to every day, they could have found him easy enough. I mean, they had LaRoche coming down from main campus sitting around for a confrontation, and the guy happened to be sick. I mean, if you construe the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant, sure, you can affirm, but you're not required to do that. And certainly, given the circumstances, Dean Johnson's secretary, after she says she'll take care of it to Hare and get him, puts her secretary inquiring about his medical status.
You guys have to say about Mills?
Yes. The issue there is two things. One, the primary issue in the case is, was there a series of acts in themselves trivial sufficient to alter her employment condition?
What was the worst thing that they did to her, in your view?
The worst thing was the daily harassment putting that in evidentiary form, you can only do as she did, tell what happened and tell what it did to her.
No, what is the worst that they did to her?
Well, the worst is an evidence of what else they did. I can't tell you the worst. You can't, when you engage in a series of petty harassments, which are actionable, over 9 months, to say which is the worst, well, that begs the question, Your Honor, with respect. That begs the question because you say, well,
all right, if you don't want to answer, you don't want to answer.
Well, the evidence I have that are the strongest is how furious Mesmer was. Secondly, if the cutback in hours were indeed legitimate, They
cut out the night part. I mean, she doesn't work till midnight because the library's closed at 9 o'clock.
Is a fact finder required to conclude that that's so, that you would terminate somebody 4 weeks before the semester's over, if you're truly saving budget? The other thing about the cutback is another person asked for, I see my time's up, another person had jobs available and then it dried up.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stiegel. Mr. Sewers?
May it please the court. Good morning. My name's Dan Sievers. Obviously, I represent the defendants in this case. Mr. Stiegel started out, as far as the first part of the Malhealthy framework, we did concede the Connick-Myers balancing test for the purposes of summary judgment. I think there was an issue as to whether the speech was actually protected, but I think for summary judgment purposes, the way that this case could best be resolved was conceding that issue. Mr. Stiegel talked a lot about the $3,400 and how that's proof that he was retaliated against. And I think it's important to look at the complaint, to look at the briefs in the court below. The claim was that Mr. Massey was terminated in retaliation for his speech. There was never a claim that not paying the $3,400 was in and of itself retaliation. You look at the complaint, the only place the $3,400 is mentioned is the damages. You look at the brief in the...
Was the refusal to pay the $3,400 connected with his termination?
I don't believe so at all.
Why did they refuse to pay the
only record of any overtime for Mr. Massey is a handwritten note on a calendar. And the issue of whether Mike Hare was a supervisor or not, Mike Hare had been his supervisor. There's evidence clearly before he wrote any letter to the legislature in situations where there's problems with maintenance in a building, a person from the main campus that's in the physical plant that has experience with buildings is put in place as a supervisor. There's evidence in the record, and Mr. Massey conceded, and his testimony was in his deposition, that Steve LaRoche had been a supervisor. At least he says they told him he was a supervisor, but before any letter to the legislature. Now certainly, Mike Hare is there on a day-to-day basis. He had been the maintenance person, but I don't think whether he's the supervisor or not is really critical to the case. The only evidence of this overtime is this handwritten note on a desk calendar of Mike Hare that is a total. It says 19 days, 6 hours. If you look at the underlying calendars, there's notations of where people have worked extra, where different things have happened. There's nothing in those underlying calendars to suggest Mike Massey worked 19 days and 6 hours.
Do these underlying calendars, are they the... record keeping, the way they keep records for overtime?
That is certainly not how the university procedure was supposed to be followed.
Did other people get paid overtime on that basis?
There's nothing in the record to support that.
Did Mr. Massey ever get paid overtime for other periods?
I don't believe there's anything in the record about that either, Judge Mannion. So the reason he wasn't paid the overtime is the only evidence is this one little note. The underlying documents don't support it, and in the proper procedures for paying overtime weren't followed. As far as the note, Mr. Stiegel wants to make this into two gossiping secretaries, and that's just not the situation. There's a letter from the chief operating officer of the Indiana Hand Center. And first, let's talk about the explanation. I mean, Mr. Stiegel's trying to make these out to be legitimate doctor notes, and I don't think that explanation holds water. Maybe for the one doctor note that's from Wishart Hospital, where Ms. Latandris worked, maybe he's got an argument there. But certainly, they called Wishart Hospital. They said this is in March, for a time off in March. They said he hasn't been a patient in August. But the important point is the other No, it was from the Indiana Hand Center. And the Miss Latandris didn't work at the Indiana Hand Center. But the Indiana Hand Center, the chief operating officer, says, guy's never been a patient. This is an outdated form. Signature doesn't appear to be one of our doctors. And we would have used a time off work form rather than a prescription pad.
What was the nurse's connection to him or to the medical facility or what?
Ms. Latandris didn't have any connection to the Indiana Hand Center, and she's actually, I think she was the girlfriend of Mr. Massey's friend.
That's the nurse named Latandris?
Yes. Yes.
She was not employed by the hospital?
She was not employed by the Indiana Hand Center.
By the Hand Center?
Correct. As far as Ms. Mills, I would like to touch on that. I think it's important that there's no evidence, as you touched on, this facility, her hours were reduced in September. The semester had started in August. Enrollment in night classes was down from 60 to 20. They only got 20 students there after 9 o'clock. So a decision was made to close the library at 9 o'clock. Then, in the record, Vice President Messmer's analysis of the program shows, and that's done in October, the analysis is done in October, hey, this facility has a $500,000 deficit. So then in November, she's terminated along with Defendant Johnson. And the number of people at this facility has gone from 26 to 13 in the last several years because we don't have any airplane mechanics students. So there's no evidence to suggest that the reason given wasn't the real reason. It's clearly based in fact, and it's clearly a legitimate reason for reducing her hours and terminating her. And as far as someone... Ms. Mills testified, oh, well, this employee asked me if I could work part-time for her. Well, then there's no evidence beyond that. That person's program was part of the facility. That's part of the $500,000 evidence. There's certainly no evidence anybody's been hired for this facility, period. There's no evidence that this person that Ms. Mills says offered her a part-time hours was allowed to have anybody do that. As far as the day-to-day harassment of Mills that's claimed, I don't think, and certainly the district court talked about that a lot of these things are trivial, and certainly the bar is low in these types of cases, and I don't know that the district court is wrong to say that a lot of these things are trivial, but I don't think the district court's holding depends on that. Judge McKinney said that, you know, all of these things, either there's no evidence that they were motivated by her speech, or they're all reasonable things to have a nighttime library assistant do. We had her order books. Well, she's an assistant to the person that runs the bookstore. And a lot of the things she complains of, actually, if you look at the record, she had to do before any of her letters to the legislature. And for that matter, there's no evidence. All of these things, her supervisor was Ellen Bowler, the person that ran the library. There's all of the things that are complained of come from Ellen Bowler. There's no evidence she was directed to do anything. And if you look at the memos between them, you can see that some of these things, any of the memorandum or reprimands, are little disputes between Ellen Bowler and Ms. Mills, and there's no evidence that Dean Johnson was involved, that Dean Johnson directed anything. And there's legitimate explanations for all of them. So there's no thread that ties these things together at all. And there's definitely no thread that ties these things to a defendant.
What about before she wrote the letter? Is there some evidence about her relations with her supervisor before then?
Actually, yes. I mean, they had a good relationship, and I'm not sure it's in the record or not. It wasn't in any of the facts below, but Ms. Mills' testimony was that actually they were still basically friends after the letter. And she said she thought Ellen Bowler was an honest person. And then the evaluation is an issue. Her evaluation that she claims Johnson influenced. There's no evidence Johnson was involved other than her statement. Ellen Bowler says she did it. And Mills even said, well, I think Miss Bowler was of the opinion that my the evaluation says her motivation was decreasing. She wasn't happy with her job. And if I can finish my statement, she says, I think Miss Bowler was of that opinion.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Stegall, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
Thank you, Judge Posner. There is evidence that this is the normal way. LaRoche brought the calendars to his deposition, the closest to Perry Mason moment I'll get, saying, well, here's the calendars, and right there in March is the way it was written. He put compilations down. Hare said he did this. And he'd submitted it, and they'd always been paid, and he never had this paperwork that 2 hours away main campus said. And let's face it, that's the way offices really work, is the recording's made and the form's filled out eventually. And
is it was your argument that they closed the library at 9 o'clock or whenever they did in order to reduce Mills's wage?
No, I think they were going to do that, but they didn't close it. When, in other words, for that semester, the other office person, Linda Kincaid, had to come in and cover after they fired Mills. So they weren't going to close it till the end of the semester. There shows retaliation. Plus, if you're closing it, you're closing the library and doing this reduction in force, why dummy up a letter, order Johnson to fire her as Mesmer did, and then tell her not to send a letter? And why dummy up this false evaluation, which Johnson did in October? All that shows the retaliation, and of course, that doesn't have to do with harassment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you to both counsel. Next case.